This episode is sponsored by Sanebox, where Inbox Zero is just one click away.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Geopolitical tensions are rising. Investors are in sell mode. The VIX surges, and our guest is Ben Hunt of Salient Partners and author of the weekly newsletter Epsilon Theory. All this and much more on episode number 505 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome aboard. Andrew Horowitz here. It is April 16th, 2017. And, well, I'm your host, as you know, of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, also the host of DH Unplugged, where we talk each and every week with John C. Dvorak about all the very fascinating and interesting topics of the week related to the business world. If you haven't had an opportunity to catch that, I very much encourage you to listen to that podcast. We actually stream it live on Tuesday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. So you can go over to DH Unplugged and check that out. There's also a chat room. Wow, what's going on, right? The week has been quite interesting. There's been a lot of turn of events that has many people wondering what the heck is going on. I mean, we've seen that the geopolitical climate has definitely changed dramatically over the last few weeks, in particular with the first bombings of, 59 or 60 Tomahawk missiles being launched into Syria as a reaction to the very bad gassings of their citizens and people in their country, which of course they're denying. But nonetheless, we had that going on. And then we had this, the Moab, M-O-A-B, the mother of all bombs, being sensationalized by the news and the media as the largest non-nuclear bomb that can actually be, exploded. And this went off in Afghanistan, and supposedly no civilians were hurt, and only targeting this particular ISIS area that they have a whole cave system, so they want to get deep and wreck their entire facility. And supposedly 31 ISIS members were killed in that particular situation. And of course, it was a very big success, according to the administration. But when you look at this and you realize that now North Korea is saying, hey, there's going to be a big event coming, and concern over the potential of having either nuclear or some kind of sarin-tipped missiles that North Korea has at their availability. And now with our armada of Navy ships steaming towards the Pacific area off of Korea, it's clearly a palpable sense that there is a incredible amount of not only tension, but concern over what exactly is the agenda with all this. Are we just chest pumping at this point and going to be saying, hey, you know what? We have the muscle, we have the backup, we have the desire to put to bed all of these things that have been going on. Or is it something more? That is the big question right now that a lot of people are really asking. And I think markets are reacting to this. There's also some earnings and some domestic policy agendas that aren't going as smoothly as one would have hoped. Already we're seeing that they're backing off the August date that Treasury Secretary Mnuchin had said, well, we are thinking that we can get this tax deal done by August. Now they're talking about the end of the year and the question whether or not there's actually going to be the ability to get the healthcare done, the repatriation done, the tax plan done at any time that seems not only timely, but also at the levels that were expected. And then there's some concern about flip-flopping and concern about the change in direction from what President Trump as a candidate was talking about as to what President Trump as president is now talking about. being very hard on China, labeling them on the first day of his presidency as a currency manipulator. That seems to be gone in the wind. And looking at NATO and how it was, a terrible thing, and now it's a good thing, and we're going to get involved with them and be back with them. And now we were friendly with Russia, now we're not friendly with Russia. I mean, there's a lot of things that are seemingly changing very rapidly that has, and I think reasonably been very concerning for market participants. Now, again, whether or not we get this all done eventually is going to be the real issue here, and whether or not it can be done at the levels that were hoped for. And we talked about this a few episodes ago about the whole idea of is the glass maybe overfull, not half full, not full, but overfull with enthusiasm, optimism, and positive sentiment that all this is going to happen very quickly. And now that we are entering into earnings season, it's where the rubber really hits the road, where reality meets expectations. And this is going to be a situation where I think people are going to be wondering, well, if we can't get this earnings push that we were hoping for, that much of the sell side analysts have been really pushing into this quarter, what's going to happen? I mean, meanwhile, we are seeing that consumer sentiment is up. The latest reading on spending is down again. We're seeing that CPI is up, and the idea that the Fed is going to raise rates seems to have resonated pretty well for a few weeks there. Now we're seeing that the 10-year is again below 230, 2.3%. So there's a weird situation going on. A lot of movement into bonds. The VIX was over 16, which was up, about 40% in the last week or so. So a lot of buying of protection against volatility, about this idea that we can use this as a hedge. We actually picked up an option for our portfolios, the TDI Managed Growth Strategy. We actually have been seeing that the Arrow strategy has been moving from short to long much more rapidly recently than we've seen over the last year. As a matter of fact, back in November, right, I think a day before the election, Arrow actually went long, held that long all the way through part of March, and then was out of the market, then went short, then went long again, and now is back to short. And that can be a very short-term situation along, but it's very interesting how all of a sudden we're seeing that not only is volatility picking up, but also the algo that we've designed for our portfolios is also seeing something that is very, very disturbing about market action right now. Even the banks that had reasonable earnings, a very nice uptick in trading revenue, as well as earnings from their yield spreads, where they can loan money out at one rate that's higher, and they can actually pay you a lot less on your deposits. That was up. There was a lot of reasonably, I think, good things that were in the banking numbers. The question is whether that's going to hold, and if some of the assumed issues about how great it was going to be with all of the deregulation in particular and tax reform, where's that going to play out when it comes to the banks? So there's a very, I would say, sketchy market backdrop that recently has formed after a significant and almost, a supercharged amount of confidence that was there for some time that we knew that it couldn't last as long as forever, obviously. But, at this point, you have to wonder, what is it going to take to get the markets to really get back on its footing here? Now, with that in mind, we've seen time and time again a 3 or 4 or maybe even a 5% little corrective action just being simply a consolidation or digestion of information. And oftentimes coming into earnings season, you will see that there is either a leap into it or a drop just before it as either concern or exuberance is mounting over the opportunity. But one of the things we do know is that this particular quarter, different than sometimes in the past, we've seen that there was a lot of drawdowns in expectations. And when companies come out, they beat and they do very well. Well, this quarter, there was a lot of a higher level of anticipation of a better earnings season. And that is now being baked into the analysis. And unfortunately, what's going to happen potentially is that a lot of companies are not going to be guiding as well as they had on the incredible amount of optimism that they saw for some time. So right now what we're seeing is that the analysts may be a little bit too jubilant in their outlook. And the question is whether or not companies will actually meet and in fact guide better moving into the future. So those are a couple of things that are going on there. But this whole issue of this geopolitical tension, I think rightfully so, while it is potentially transitory, right? Maybe if we're just dropping a couple of bombs here or there and flexing our muscle right now, and it could die down and just becomes a nothing event. It appears that markets are sensing something is greater here. Something is much more of a concern that maybe a little bit more than just simply a transitory, situation here. And as we see that there is the desire for much more protectionism and into next week's French elections, I mean, there's a lot of things going on. Anyway, I want to get to our guest because I know we're going to talk about a lot of different things. This is someone who we've had on before and how I've spoken to before and read all of the stuff. Before we do that, I have to mention something. And I have to mention, I've talked to you about this before because it's a great tool because emails can be a real pain, right? You know, you have all these emails that come in and trying to sort through the things that are good versus bad, looking at what is junk, what's not junk. And sometimes your systems will do a pretty good job at getting rid of some of that. But sometimes your email box gets really clogged up. I know that mine did. And I learned about this whole idea of inbox zero, this whole holy grail of just really having nothing there pending because all the bad stuff is put aside. It's called SaneBox, SaneBox. And I tell you something, I recommend it highly because it sorts through your email and moves all your the trivial things, the non-important, the junk to a different folder. So only the messages that you see in your inbox are the ones you actually want to see. Now, aside from just simply moving the junk on one place to another, they have something called the black hole. And I've mentioned this. This is really cool. And the black hole, what it does is when you move an email into that folder, the black hole folder, what happens is you'll never hear from that sender again. It's awesome. Because you, myself, everybody that we know has the opportunity now to be much more organized, save a lot of time, and get your email life in order. And what we did is we worked out a great deal for listeners. You can go to SaneBox.com, SaneBox.com/TDI, and they'll throw in an extra $20 credit on top of the absolutely free, no strings attached, 2-week free trial. And the good news is you don't even have to enter a credit card. A lot of times these trials, you have to enter a credit card. Not this one. Just simply check it out and see how much you love this thing. There's really nothing you can lose besides maybe some wasted time. You'll be getting that back. Check it out today and let me know how much you love this thing, especially the black hole. Go over to SaneBox, SaneBox.com/TDI. Well, let's get to what you've been waiting for, what I've been waiting for, and get on with this discussion. I think this is going to be very interesting. And our guest today is Ben Hunt, and he's the Chief Risk Officer at Salient Partners, which is an investment management firm with offices in Houston, San Francisco, New York. He's author of the wonderfully written Epsilon Theory, which is a weekly newsletter and website that examines markets through the lens of a game theory and history. And I'll tell you, folks, I've read his stuff, and I read it quite often. Fascinating. So thanks for coming aboard today. I appreciate it.
No, my pleasure, Andrew, and thanks for the kind words.
Well, you know, I was thinking, I got to tell you something. This may get a little weird right now, but recently I was reading one of your pieces, and then I had a dinner, and during this dinner I had this wonderful foie gras. It was lightly fried. It was this truffle sauce, and it was topped with cotton candy. As crazy as that may sound, and I was thinking, my gosh, the infinite kind of depth of the flavor and the rich aroma, the textures, and this little bitty piece, this small little morsel that I ate was so incredibly, not only, I don't want to say filling as in I was full, but it was it was so much in it, in each little piece. And then I said, you know, I feel like that when I read your work.
Well, that's one of the nicest things I've heard someone say about my work.
Yeah.
I know, and
it's a piece of liver.
Having had my share of liver, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, if you eat liver, you'll know what it's like to read his work. No, but seriously, it's like that. You know, I was reading. As a matter of fact, I was reading one of your more recent pieces that is entitled "The Horse in Motion," which was back at the end of March. And seriously, no kidding. I'm not even kidding about this. I mean, I was through like the first paragraph. I'm like, I feel content that I'm really well up on what he's talking, you know, that this is just a full piece of information already. I feel so much more educated. But let's talk about that, the horse in motion. And you talked about this whole idea of artificial intelligence. And just one point before you get into this, it is one of those words that's being, or the phrases that's just being thrown around for everything lately. Everything's AI.
So true.
You know, it's AI.
Everything's AI.
You know, my computer.
Everything's AI. But, you know, there's, it's a phrase I don't really like, right? Because I'll use a $10 word here, anthropomorphic, right? I mean, it's saying that these, what we're talking about are what I like to call non-human intelligences, right? I mean, there's, we can call them artificial if you like, but that's kind of pejorative and makes it seem kind of fake or artificial. It's just very different from the way in which humans, in our biologically evolved and trained brains, perceive the world. But where it's interesting to me is that it is pervasive both in the language. But I got to tell you, the technology that's been developed over the last few years is, well, my view, it's the most important thing happening in the world right now. It is it really does change everything, including changing everything in our investment world.
One of the things you talked about in that story, and it was a whole idea you went back to, and you looked at how it was found out that, yes, in fact, indeed, that horses will have for just a moment, a split second, all of their hooves off the ground as they're galloping, right? And the process that went into finding out about that, the snapshotting and the slow motion or stop motion photography that was involved. And you're now saying that possibly some of the things that we're looking at today, when you can slice a piece and just stop motion and see what's happening and put it together, will enable us to somehow understand a little bit more about social behavior. Is that a good summary?
Well, that's exactly right. But the example I was giving was goes back to the 1870s, and there was this guy. His name was Edward Muybridge, and he was out in San Francisco, and he was a pretty weird dude, but he was one of the first technologists, right? So he was a San Francisco technology nerd back in the 1870s, and today it would be venture capital. Back then, it was rich guys like this guy Leland Stanford of Stanford University fame. He was this really rich guy out there, and so instead of being a venture capitalist like today to develop a technology, Leland Stanford said, look, Muybridge, I understand you've developed this new technology for taking stop-action photography, right? So photography was still very much in its infancy, and Muybridge had come up with this system to take, really the first stop-action photograph. So you could capture animals, humans, anything in motion. You could really see it, the biomechanics of animals, or the way the way that a bird flew or a human
or a plant,
ran.
A plant grows over time, let's say, or something.
But of course, their interest was on tracking things that would move so quickly to the human eye. They wanted to try to get new information out of this, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, the connection where I'm going to go is that there are things that move too fast for the human eye in markets. And so the technology today, very similarly to Muybridge's stop action photography back then, is really one of the reasons I don't like the name artificial intelligence. It's not a decision making technology. What it is a tool. It's a tool where we humans can see things and can perceive things differently. So what Stanford wanted Muybridge to do with his technology was settle this long-running bet, which is do all four hooves of a horse leave the ground at the same time? And the prevailing wisdom was, well, yes, they do, but they leave the ground in the I'll call it the splayed out position, the flying position. Well, my bridge, and this is he wrote a there's a famous book about it in the series of photographs. He took stop action photographs of the galloping horse, and sure enough, all four hooves leave the ground at the same time, but only in the tucked in position. That's when the four hooves leave the ground. And it was something that no one had really put forward as a possibility, even a possibility, because it's just not very romantic, right? You know, we want to have the romantic story that, you know, horses fly across the ground and all four hooves leave when they are in that outstretched position. And what Muybridge found out was that, you know, reality is actually a little different, and that by looking at what I'll call unstructured data, so unstructured data are things like photographs, articles that are written. You know, he was able to use his new technology to take snapshots of this unstructured data, you know, pictures of the world. Well, what we're able to do now with these artificial intelligence, again, I hate that term, but we'll use it. What we're able to use it is in the same way that Muybridge did, as a tool to take snapshots, not of a horse running, but of a market in motion. We're able to take snapshots of all the articles that are written on Bloomberg about what's going on today. I mean, I was just looking today about how when the market was up, it was because the bank earnings were good. And then, of course, now the market's down. And the next story was, well, it's down despite good bank earnings. And now I just saw the article on Bloomberg, because now all the big banks, they're down on the day too, saying, well, maybe those bank earnings weren't so good after all.
Right?
So you take these snapshots of the unstructured data. That's what the technology allows you to do. And what we're finding is new ways of looking at things. And a lot of the things we thought about markets in motion turn out to be just as false as thinking that horses in motion run in a flying manner with all four hooves, you know, stretched out in a splayed position.
But Ben, where do we go from here? So now we have this information available, and that's today. What the technology allows us to do today. But where do we go with this? And what's the point of all this? Is it just to make that incremental extra penny on a trade?
No. It's a much bigger thing, Andrew. And I'm so glad you asked it that way. So. What I think we're entering is what I'll call is the fourth generation of fund strategies. And the first generation, I'll call it, is the human discretionary model, where human beings with our big brains, you know, we perceive the world and we see patterns and we make investments accordingly. By the way, this process that I'm describing to you, this isn't just for investments. Right, I see it in the energy business, which, you know, Salient does a lot with. I see it in the transportation business. I see it in every walk of life, where again you start in what I'm going to call the discretionary model, where it's humans and our big brain.
Yeah, observation.
And it is right. In about 20, 25 years ago, we moved into what I'll call is the programmatic model, which is, you know, we've got the first computers, especially personal computers, so that it democratizes this sort of processing power. And so people, there are real advantages to having a computer processor, you know, think about a data set, because it can move quickly, right? It can make the calculations faster than a human can. And so, you know, we saw these first sort of kind of programmatic trading strategies. Again, I'll just focus on the investment application here. And from there, we evolved into the third stage, which is where we are today, which is what I'll call quant or big data, right? So if you look at I think last year's numbers, the 10 most successful hedge funds, you know, investment fund, private funds in the world, in terms of how much money they made, you know, 7 of the top 10 were quant funds. Or I'll call them semi-quant funds, where it's, you know, you've got some human decision making, but it's still mostly machines running the just more programs. So there's no real difference between programmatic and quant. It's just that quant, you know, a human being doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah, they have the black box. They have the on and off switch.
That's right. That's right.
That's basically what they do. That's the responsibility.
Yeah. That's essentially the responsibility. And my belief is that, you know, 3-5 years from now, if things were continuing to go like they're going, you know, 10 out of 10 will be quant funds, right? Because you get these firms that have made this enormous investment just in more and more horsepower, you know, to stick with our analogy from before, to crunch more and more data sets and find these vanishingly small anomalies in the, you know, in either a price series or a volume series. You know, once you've invested the sort of money, let's call it a D.E. Shaw or a Two Sigma is invested in this stuff, it's just very hard for us mere mortals to ever catch up with that.
The problem is that this is so far away from the baseline of what investing is all about. It's just so, it's not even reminiscent of it at all.
That you're exactly right.
It's like the difference between a gourmet, back to my meal discussion, a gourmet meal and having a TV dinner, or even better yet, it's from having a home cooked meal to a pill that just fills me up.
I hear you, but like I say, you know, the most profitable firms in the world are doing this, right? But here's my point. Here's where I'm going with this. I'll call it AI, but what I really, the phrase I really like is a phrase that my partner uses called big compute, right? So it's not big data. It's not collecting every data, the structured data about the world. It's big compute. And it goes by the name artificial intelligence, or I call it non-human intelligence. But it's not its own thing. What it does is, I really believe this, it rescues human discretionary investing. Right? It allows me as an investor, because I can now take these snapshots of market sentiment, it allows me to make better investment decisions. I ask questions of the artificial intelligence. The AI is not there to say, oh, invest in this or invest in that. It's a tool. I'll back up one more time, right? So the AI that I found the most use is this artificial intelligence. It's been trained on 2 billion documents, and it's been trained to read. Right. That's what it does. That's all this AI does is it knows how to read. Now we think, oh, well, that's silly. I mean, humans, we know how to read and we know how to do a million other things. An AI, it only knows how to do one thing, but it can do it really, really well. Mm-hmm. And that's what I mean about being able to see the world differently, better, in like one tiny respect. In this case, reading. And reading everything instantaneously and comparing everything it's read to everything else it's ever read and what you can do with that sort of power.
And the interpretation of that.
But that's right. It's the human, right, that has to ask the right question of that AI. You know, technology friends, they talk about, well, what's it like to build an AI? And they say, you know, it's like training a child. We talk about training an artificial intelligence. He says it's like teaching a child how to do something. Now, what we're trying to do right now in my group is we're trying to train this AI not on 2 billion general documents, but just on the documents that are in our world of investing. Where the word overweight is a positive thing. You know, overweight is a positive word in our world of investing. It's a negative word in the more generalist application. So the opportunity today is to train. We'll end up with a really weird child. We'll end up with a really weird child. That'll be a child that will be able to do things that no human can. And in partnership with humans to ask the right questions, is very powerful.
I wanted to skip ahead to another piece that you wrote back in the beginning of March again, and this is all available. These you can get these if you want over on salient sites called Epsilon Theory. You can sign up for the newsletter, et cetera, find out more. We'll have information on the show notes of this episode where you can get in touch with them to get this. But you talk about the European story is broken. This is another thing. So the first thing we talked about is I am so sick of the word AI. The second thing I'm done with is valuations are much more appealing in Europe.
Oh my God. Isn't that the truth, Andrew? You know, like you have been doing this for a long time, I have rarely seen such a powerful drumbeat, such a powerful sell-side message to buy Europe. And not just to buy Europe, okay, once they get through these elections and the like, but no. You got to buy Europe now.
Yeah.
You got to buy it now. And I've been racking my brain, you know, to try to understand this. And I've actually got a new Epsilon Theory note coming out on this. But I'll give you the sneak preview of why I think we've seen such this incessant drumbeat. Like I say, it's you know, almost unique in its scope and just ubiquity that, oh yeah, Europe's cheap. You got to buy Europe, and you got to buy it now. So let me know why I think this is going on, because the large institutional investors that we interact with and invest alongside, almost all of them are shorting European bonds, and they're shorting European bonds because it's the old joke about, well, you know, heads I win and tails you lose. Mm-hmm. The idea is that, well, let's say that Le Pen wins in France, or there's some other sort of anti-Euro populist political success in Europe this year. So what's going to happen to, let's say, French bonds, right? They are going to sell off dramatically relative to German bonds, right? There's just no doubt that's going to. I mean, I don't think there's much of a doubt that that's going to happen, right? So that would be this event where people would really start to question the solidity of the entire Euro system. You know, it's a skepticism and a questioning I very much share. It's just a question of time, right? So the big institutional investors are looking at these European bonds, and they're saying, okay, if things go sideways in Europe, right, if things get squirrely, you know, I want to be short these bonds, right? And so, because mm-hmm. that's going to do well for me. All right. Well, what happens if things go really well in Europe? Let's say that all the events are positive, and you know, we don't have in France or in Italy some threat of, you know, leaving the euro system and the like. Well, you know, in that case, you're going to start to see some significant growth, anti-austerity. You're going to see inflation. And what happens to those bonds in that situation? They sell off that way too.
How do they right? sell? So why would they sell off in that yeah. situation?
Well, because inflation is going to be bad for bonds. Right, so I want to be short the bonds.
I guess
France,
I guess that's with the giant assumption that Draghi's not going to continue doing his little drumbeat where he's going to try to, you know, keep his arsenal. I mean, look what happened here recently, right? Things were getting better, growth was getting better, and all of a sudden we see the 10 back at under 230 again.
I hear you. Let's come back to that.
So let's come back to reality in a moment. Let's talk about what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. But what I'm trying to describe is that there's been this very widespread trade in the institutional investment community to short these bonds in, call it, France and Italy and the like, right? But here's the thing. If you are a financial advisor, or let's say you're – or let's do better. Yeah, let's say you're the strategist for, you know, one of the big wirehouses. Right? You can't go out and recommend to your financial advisors to short bonds, right? A, they can't really do it.
Mm-hmm.
And B, their business model, the sell side business model, isn't based on shorting or selling anything. You've got to buy.
Yeah.
Right, their whole business model is based on buying.
Sure.
Right. So, where the connection is made is that they're saying, well, if we think that bonds are a sale, if we think you need to be selling or shorting your bonds, well, naturally that means you need to be buying the equities. Right. That's how a wirehouse advisor or the like would express the notion of selling bonds, right? You buy equities. And so I really think that that's how this reasonable and very pervasive institutional investment theme of shorting or selling European bonds has now been translated into this drumbeat in the more retail side of things to say, oh, well, you need to be buying those equities. And of course, as we know, it's not the same thing, right? You know, bonds can go down and equities can go down for sure when you have a big political shock. But that's what I think is really driving this ubiquitous narrative that, you know, like you, just drives me nuts.
Or said another way, it is a story that has been created to fit their need to find an area to pump.
Correct. Yep. You got it.
That's simply that. All right. And finally,
you got it, Andrew.
Finally, I wanted to just touch on your thoughts on this whole political mess. Well, that's my words. I don't know about your words, but this whole political environment that we are in now, which you talk about in this piece about the, you know, this game of chicken and the prisoner's dilemma and the whole idea of getting away from a time when we were looking to have a happy kumbaya cooperative world environment where, you know, there's no longer a stewardess, but it's a flight attendant, and no longer is that our enemy, but now we'll figure out a way to make it our palsy wowsy, and into this new area of competition, which then connotes that there is people at the top that will be pointing and saying, you're no good, we're better than you are, and how that plays out.
You know, I try to write about two things. I try to write about game theory, which is it's a very different animal from the academic and professional economics today. The game theory is all about human interactions. So people ask me what is game theory. Well, it's that old expression in poker where, you know, you don't just play the cards. You also have to play the player, and game theory is playing the player. That's what game theory is.
Right.
Playing the player. And so when I talk about game theory, that can make people say, it gets very ethereal or worse, abstract and mathematical, and it's some sort of model like econometrics. It's not the case at all, right? So game theory is all about expressing these actually very simple ideas and experiences that every one of us has had in real life. But the idea is to try to put some structure around it so that we can see when these underlying patterns repeat themselves in different situations and in different time periods. And so that's also why I like to write about history, because it's trying to draw these connections between different periods of time and what's going on in politics, but especially what's going on in markets. So I've been writing a lot about the way in which the underlying pattern, and in this case it's what I'll call the game of chicken, how this underlying pattern is so similar to the pattern that we saw in markets and in politics in the 1930s. It's it's the sort of thing as Mark Twain, everyone always says Mark Twain said something, right? But I think this really was a quote from him, where he said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I try to write about. I try to write about the rhyme of history. And really trying to isolate what are those underlying patterns, the games that we can see repeating themselves, and I think it's important to do it because games, and here's another $10 word, have equilibriums, right? They have balancing points. They have outcomes that one can anticipate if you get a sense of what game is being played here. And one of the things we saw in the 1930s and we're seeing today, in fact, we've seen it in history, whenever you have so much debt sloshing around the world, which leads to this sort of what I'll call political polarization, which leads to a pendulum swinging back and forth in terms of income and wealth distribution, and all of this stuff getting cashed out in politics. This game of competition, which God knows the Donald has mastered, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Where everything becomes, you know, us versus them, me versus you. Everything is couched in terms of the either we have a winner, either I'm the winner or I'm the loser. There's no in between. Now, the reason I say that this is interesting and it's a game of chicken is it's very different from other famous games like the Prisoner's Dilemma, right? So the Prisoner's Dilemma, it's also a competitive game, right? But there's a chance in the Prisoner's Dilemma, it's hard, but there's the chance for both of us, both you and me, Andrew, to end up better off than we were before.
Or not worse right? off. Look at it that way.
Or not worse off, right? At least not worse off, but in most cases, better off.
Okay.
Both of us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's hard to get to in a Prisoner's Dilemma, right? So this is the classic, you know, Law and Order, episode where they separate out the two suspects mm-hmm. and they try to get one to rat on the other. And, you know, the rational thing to do, the typical equilibrium is for both to rat on each other. Right, so they're both worse off than they were before. But it's possible, and there are different ways to play this game to make this more likely, for both of them to keep their mouth shut, for neither one to rat out the other, and then the police don't have a case against either one. Right, so they're both better off than before. The game of chicken, which is the game I think we're in now, so different. It's so different. You know, you're driving your pickup truck at Kevin Bacon's pickup truck. Right, there's only a chicken and a winner. There is no ability for both of you to be better off by being chickens together, right?
Yeah.
Even the name of it kind of shows it. And just like in the 1930s, our political system, not just in this country but every other country, it fragments and it moves into these games of pure competition, like chicken. And I'd love to tell you that there's a happy ending to this, but unfortunately, when you look at history, it typically takes a big, bad event. It usually takes a common enemy, like in a war, to get out of these games of competition, these games of chicken that we are playing domestically today.
And that's not going to be something easy to get away from, and especially if it's embraced, by the way, by the public somehow, that we start finding an enemy somewhere, whether it's another country or maybe it's just, you know, at this point it's going to be ISIS or, you know, looking at how bad we've been treated. I mean, because really, if you think about it, a lot of the political discussions through this entire process of the last year has all been about all the other people. Everybody's bad, by the way. Everybody's bad. Everybody's breaking the law. You know, we're going to do something about this. Bring American jobs. I mean, the thought of a wall, the thought of protectionism. I mean, that's great. We're going to buy our products. Wait a minute. We spent the last 20 years, 25 years building up a global economy, and all of a sudden to try to shut that faucet off. That can't get done without any pain to me.
No, Andrew, you're so right. And again, it's not just something that happened over the last 25 years. We've got another example of this. And again, it's the 1930s. Right? So in 1930, the summer of 1930, the U.S. passed the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it set up tariffs and quotas on probably about 1,000 different imported items that came into the United States. And, you know, over the next year, almost every country responded in kind, right? So that's the nature of a competitive game. The other country is not going to say, oh, I'm sorry, yes, let me, you know, do whatever you're asking. No, they're going to – it's not war by military means, right? But it's competition, it's conflict on economic terms, mm-hmm. and other countries follow suit. Well, you know, actually the U.S. economy did okay after the Smoot-Hawley bill was passed, because then as now, the U.S. economy is primarily a domestically driven economy, right? So the U.S. consumer is, I don't know, like 70% of GDP,
yeah.
something like that,
yep.
right? And it was very similar in the 1930s.
But we had more manufacturing then, and we had much more dependence on our own crops, didn't we?
Well, from an agrarian point of view, right? Yeah, we were absolutely a more agrarian society, mm-hmm. and we had much more self-reliance. So the mix of that domestically driven economy was different in the 1930s than today. But my point is simply that then as now, direct trade, you know, what we import, and if it costs a little bit more to get stuff in from Mexico or from Great Britain back then, you know, it was a drag on the economy, but it wasn't a horrible drag on the economy. All right, but bear with me for a second, because it's going to get to exactly your point about the interconnectedness of this global economy. Because the interconnectedness is not really at the consumer level, although it's there, but there are substitutes for what, you know, you get from Walmart, or, you know, if it's being imported from Walmart cheap, you know, maybe it costs you a little bit more to pay for it, but it's not that big of a hit on the U.S. economy.
Mm-hmm.
Here's where the hit is. The hit happens in the financial system. It happens in the banks. And I'm not saying that that's good or that's bad. I'm just saying it is. All right, so in 1931, the summer of 1931, one of the biggest European banks went bankrupt, a bank called Kreditanstalt. Now, why did it go bankrupt? Because European banks then and now, what we'll call merchant banks, are levered to global trade.
Mm.
So, you know, they are the canaries in the coal mine when it comes to these sort of trade issues. When the global trade pie starts to shrink, it's the banks, the ones who are lending money to these trading companies and these international shippers and the like, they're the ones who feel it most acutely.
Mm.
And so in the summer of 1931, Kreditanstalt shut its doors, and that set off a financial crisis, which immediately rippled through Wall Street and led to the next big leg down in the real economy of the United States. So what I'm saying is that, again, the history rhyming doesn't repeat exactly, but it sure does rhyme. Then as now, or rather now as then, it's the European banks that are most sensitive to reductions in global trade. It's the European banks, a few Asian banks as well, that are horribly undercapitalized. It's the European banks now as then that I think are the epicenter for the next shock. And it's the sort of shock now as then that immediately hops across the Atlantic Ocean to our capital markets and our banks, even though they're less vulnerable to this than the European banks, it all gets knocked down. So I think that's what we need to be looking at, and I think that's the trajectory for how, if things go sideways and squirrely, I think that's how it happens.
And I think, by the way, just to cap that, it would seem to me that one of the initial shots that was fired on this, if it is to be a rhyme in history, I would think has to be Brexit to a degree, whereas there may be some quartering off of the banking and financial, the financial dealings with mm-hmm. the English or the UK-based banks and the financial institutions there from Europe, and then therefore possibly having some further problems.
No, it's a good point. It's a good point, Andrew. I think that the reason you were seeing the Europeans play such hardball with the Brits is that they want to use the UK as an example, right? They want to punish the UK for invoking Article 50 mm-hmm. and, you know, trying to get out of the European Union, because while it's an inconvenience for the UK to leave the EU, and it is an inconvenience, because they don't share the same currency, it's not an existential thing,
yeah,
right? So
right.
what they want to do is they want to be as mean and set as cruel an example as they can with the UK so that Italy doesn't get any ideas.
Right.
So that France doesn't get any ideas. Right. But I got to tell you, that horse has already left the barn. It's just already left the barn.
I hear you. I hear you. Great stuff. Ben Hunt again from Salient Partners and author of Epsilon Theory. We'll have all the information on how to get in touch with him on the website. Now, appreciate you coming on board. And I have a feeling that many of our listeners are never going to eat a piece of foie gras the same again.
Love it, Andrew.
All right, thanks.
Always a pleasure.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye. I can't encourage you enough to press you to make sure to read all that Ben Hunt writes. It's just a fascinating discussion of information. And his writing style is, I think, not only enjoyable, but enriching. So just definitely go over to the Salient Partners Epsilon Theory website and download and check out those newsletters. They're just fascinating. Anyway, we're going to wrap it up here. If you have any questions, please do me a favor and go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And what you can do is on the top, there's a little button that says Ask Andrew. You can ask me questions. We'll get to some of those questions you have on the next episode. And if they're not appropriate maybe for an episode because they may be more personal, I'll do my best to answer them directly in an email. And of course, you could find out information about what we've been talking about, a couple of thoughts here and there on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Some of the information about DH Unplugged is on there, as well as the information and all you need to know about our various strategies, the things that you want to learn about in terms of our Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, the Aero Strategy, as well as our Global Allocation Strategies and the upcoming, which is now in the beginnings of launching of a beta test for Investology. So a lot of information there. I encourage you to check that out. And of course, do me a favor, follow me on Twitter. Andrew Horowitz, one word, is the Twitter handle where I put up some charts. I put up some information. Of course, every time a podcast or other commentary is posted, an article, an analysis, it also goes right on the Disciplined Investor website and also right to Twitter. So make sure to get that going so you have instant access. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.